composition makes you everything that you are, from your body to your temperament to your psyche to how you can make an impact in the world. It's profound and powerful, and it becomes even more powerful when you realize that you were literally made perfectly, that you can use all of those strengths to minimize all of your weaknesses. It's like, wow, I was made so perfect that I was given every single resource that I need to overcome all of my problems and limitations.
In the Ayurvedic tradition, our constitutions are categorized into different types, called doshas. These doshas, vata, pitta, and kapha, define the best types of food to eat in order to be healthy, vital, energized, and to avoid inflammation and illness. It's a beautiful idea, and for thousands of years people have adopted this Ayurvedic principle to live a bright and energetic life. But what if we could take it beyond diet? What if we could define our type and then use this in order to create a life of fulfillment, meaning, and contentment? I'm Chris Brock, and this is Conversations on Living, a podcast about being well, doing well, and living well. This week, I'm joined by author and mindfulness expert Jaya Jayamira, who turned to Ayurvedic principles when doctors couldn't solve the chronic illness that was costing her not just her health, but also her career, her relationships, her financial stability, and more. And as she explored and played with the concepts behind Ayurveda, she found that not only did her health improve, but also her wider life too. This led her to present an eye-opening TEDx talk, to become a television wellness expert, to set up her own boutique PR agency, and to write several books, including this one that I'm holding here, The Soul of Purpose. Her message is this, that all aspects of our lives are connected, and that when we want to live in alignment with our purpose, we can live a life filled with health and wellness, and that by understanding ourselves, we can discover that purpose. You can find out more about her and her work at www.jayajayamira.com. And before I get into that conversation, I just want to give a quick shout out to the guys at Headliner. Headliner is the app that I use to create those audiograms with which I market this podcast. I give them a shout out every episode of the podcast because they support this podcast with their service. And it's a great service. So if you host a podcast and you want to create those audiograms, which are kind of audio clips with moving waveforms or captions, then Headliner is definitely the easiest and most powerful way to do it. And you can find out more about that at headliner.app. Also, a quick shout out about Plane. Plane is a meditation game. It's a virtual environment where you are encouraged to create and grow a beautiful island just using the power of mindfulness. There's some great relaxation techniques in there. And if you are intrigued by the idea of meditation and mindfulness, but don't know how to get into it, but you like video games, then this could be the thing for you. You can find it by searching for meditation game, and it's usually the first result that comes up. Or you can go to www.plane.co. That's Plaine. And just a quick shout out for the podcast as well. I'd love it if you could subscribe, rate, and review, and tell all your friends about it. And if you want to find out more about other episodes and other conversations, including my writings and meditations and things like that, then head over to the website at conversationsonliving.com. Anyway, that's enough about that. Now it's time to get into this wonderful and very inspiring conversation with the fantastic Jaya Jayamira. So Jaya Jayamira, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. You're in New York where it's the morning right now. And you're a mind-body wellness expert. And your kind of theory is that if you want to live a kind of balanced and happy, fulfilled life, then you have to find your purpose and live in alignment with that. And that is different for everybody. And it's something you can discover by discovering your type, if you like. And I use kind of inverted commas there because, yeah, absolutely. Because it's different for everybody. And this is something you were working in cancer research. So you're a scientist originally. And then
you had your own struggles with fibromyalgia, and it was quite devastating. And that took you on a journey to something which could be seen as being, well, maybe not so scientific, but there is a kind of, you know, you speak to anyone in Ayurveda or Chinese medicine, and they would probably disagree with me saying that.
Spiritual science is real, but it's definitely nothing like Western science or Western medicine.
Absolutely. Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your discovery, how you discovered the kind of connection between your type, the kind of mind body wellness connection. And then we can sort of see where the conversation takes us based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, I started my career as a research scientist. I was working in cancer research, working in immunology. It was rewarding and it was fulfilling to me at the time, but there were definitely aspects of my work that I didn't like. I didn't like animal testing. I didn't like killing animals for the sake of trying to heal people. That seemed like a broken paradigm, let's just say. So when I faced my own health crisis, when I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, it was really devastating for me. I wasn't able to work. I wasn't able to function or do anything. It was kind of the same time as I was having this massive crisis of conscience about this work and why do we test on animals and why do we do this? And then medicine really couldn't help me. Western medicine had no solutions. Their fibromyalgia drugs, quote unquote, you see me doing the little air quotes now too, actually made me worse. Nothing helped me to feel better. So I was forced to find my own ways to heal. I mean, and this was back in the mid 2000s. So we know a lot more now about fibromyalgia than we did then, but we still, as a scientific community, don't truly know that much. They do know now that it is not something that is in people's minds. Back when I was diagnosed, some doctors thought this was totally a psychosomatic thing. They now know that people with fibromyalgia literally feel more pain, like the neural conduction is different, and people who are diagnosed with it literally feel more pain because it's just not getting, like, those nerve fibers are not getting shielded in the same way that it would for a normal person without that disease. So I was really forced to reevaluate a lot of things. I was forced to reevaluate my career. I ended up leaving my career as a scientist. I had to find natural ways to heal myself because medicine couldn't help, which is ultimately why I left my career as a scientist. Why am I doing this to try and cure diseases when this is not able to even cure me? So I did find other paradigms. I went to mindfulness, meditation, Ayurveda. I started making some very big life changes. And as I was doing these things, I noticed that I started getting better. And part of what I did was working with my own unique constitution. Like you were talking about your purpose, your type. That definitely came a little bit later. I mean, I had to get a basic footing underneath myself. I was so sick. I couldn't work. I couldn't cook. I couldn't take care of my kids. I couldn't do anything. I had to get some stability back before I could further progress, you know, but once I was at least halfway through that journey, I started adopting more of the type modalities that started really, really helping me. And I guess to answer your question, I mean, I did study with an Eastern spiritual teacher, but the things that I learned really came to me directly in my own meditations through my own consciousness. And I had to just trust what I was being taught. And then I later learned everything that I was being guided to inwardly was 100% in alignment with Ayurvedic philosophy and traditional Chinese medicine philosophy. So I think that the process of mindfulness meditation just helped me to tap into that universal consciousness where all information is available to us. And I was led on a path that was, one, going to heal me, and two, I truly hope sheds a lot of light and further understanding for other people, because I have found that practitioners of both of these systems don't often talk about the psychological and mental impacts of Ayurveda and Chinese medicine. And to me, like, that's truly foundational. Understanding your type, understanding your purpose, understanding how all of these things that are non-tangible create our tangible physical bodies is hugely It's hugely important because it deepens your connection with yourself, with God. It deepens your faith. It's like really this bridge that brings things together. It's not just, hey, here's my physical health. Here's, hey, this is how this is all truly, truly working together to foster everything at the same time. I think too many people look at Ayurveda and say, this is a health modality that can fix your body and it can fix your mind, but they're not looking at it from the other perspectives. They're not looking at the very holistic view that, no, this is just a tiny piece of the puzzle and you've got to be able to connect everything together. It's not just all, it's not that all about your health. You can't start looking at it just from a physical level. You have to start looking at it from a higher level. Like, where did things form from? Does that make sense? At least a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it raises a question in my head. I mean, in the West, we're very much kind of taught throughout our life to look at the world around us, to act in the world outside of us. And when things go wrong, we look to medicine to fix the thing that is wrong, the symptom. In your TEDx talk, you talked very much about how the majority of illnesses that are, you know, the big illnesses in the West are caused by lifestyle choices.
Yes,
definitely. But we seem very reluctant to look at our lifestyle, to look at ourselves.
And because no one wants to believe it, to be honest. We grow up with a societal script or narrative. Grow up, get married, have 2.5 kids, have the stellar career and the white picket fence. We have these societal scripts or narratives. Some people would call that societal karma. I think any words we want to use are good. I'm just going to use a bunch of them so maybe more people can identify with it. We just grow up thinking that we know what life is supposed to look like, and we are not taught that mind, body, and soul are truly the same thing that's manifesting itself in a different way. We are taught to believe that these are all separate and distinct things from each other, and that maybe they've got some connection or not, but we're just not taught to understand things as they truly are. So we don't put a lot of validity into the notion that meditation, mindfulness, Ayurveda, these other natural practices truly work and why. You know, we're physical beings after all, right? I think it would be very helpful if people shifted their perspective to realize that we are a soul that has manifested a tangible physical body. And when you start on the soul level, you can fix all problems from the inside out.
I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense that, you know, and medicine proves this already. You know, when you get stressed, you get illnesses, you get headaches, yes, you get, you know, stomach ulcers, things like this.
Cortisol increases, your hormones get out of balance, your probiotic, your microintestinal flora gets out of balance, which damages your mental health.
So why do you think it's kind of so taboo almost to talk about kind of spirituality as a kind of as a health issue, or to talk about the kind of mental practice of calm and stress reduction as a kind of health issue and a life issue?
Because doctors and scientists are taught to only speak in terms of things that they can prove, and we still cannot prove that there is a soul. So since this cannot be proven by Western scientific standards, the whole idea of spirituality and consciousness is normally thrown out. Now, I think that that's starting to change within the last few years as we have more people, more doctors, more physicians that are touting the benefits of mindfulness and meditation. I think we're just collectively changing as a society to understand that, hey, you know what, your feelings really do matter. And if you need to go to a yoga class or you need to sit and do a meditation to improve your feelings, this will improve your physical health.
Do you think that a lot of the diseases we're encountering today, particularly things like mental health problems, you know, we've got heart disease, we've got all these kind of modern, would you call them industrial diseases maybe, do you think they are a kind of a symptom of an incompatibility between our kind of natural selves and this kind of artificial world of 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, high pressure, highly processed, everything we consume is highly processed, from our foods to our information, even, you know?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. And it's interesting. I actually have a friend that his life's work is really talking about the environmental impacts of heart disease, which would show that the things that we're doing to our environment and the way that we live our lives has a much greater impact on heart disease than people would have thought. But yes, the highly processed foods, all of this, again, wreaks havoc with the microbiome in your gut. They now know, like science now knows, that it's your microbiome that actually strongly impacts your mental health and well-being. If your microbiome is not strong and stable, you will have depression and anxiety and sadness and fear. So like eating natural, healthy foods, things that we actually have to cook that are not processed and prepared, definitely goes a long way to fixing that. Getting out into fresh air, getting out into nature, getting away from all the environmental toxins. And I say this knowing full well that I live in New York City. You know, you can't get any bigger and more industrialized than that, but we still have to spend time out in nature and get away, from all the toxic lifestyle that we have. Yeah. The 9-to-5 lifestyle is not necessarily a healthy one. And people, again, I think we're just not taught how to deal with stress in this culture, how to cultivate resilience. You're just, again, taught that societal script, go get the job, have the marriage, have the 2.5 kids. But we don't learn the appropriate coping mechanisms to be able to deal with any of those things effectively.
I think it's very true. I think I've spoken on this podcast before about this kind of evolutionary mismatch. You know, the world is accelerating faster than our kind of animal genome can catch up. So we're still living in the jungle, or at least our bodies think we are, experiencing things like fear because, you know, we might be about to get trampled by a woolly mammoth or something. But now that's being translated to when the phone rings, or if we're going to miss the deadline for that piece of work or whatever, if we're going to miss our bus. So we're living in this very kind of unhealthy, disconnected kind of diet of the way we consume the world around us.
That is so true. You know, most of the scenarios are not going to cause imminent death like they would have if we were, like you said, living out in the jungle or something. Yeah, you miss that deadline, no one's going to bring an axe down on your throat, but fear makes you think that.
Absolutely. And it manifests in all kinds of ways that can also lead to, you know, poor health. I mean, you talked about the gut, they call it the second brain. Yes. I heard an interview with Penn Jillette, the conjurer, and he became vegan just to, as a bit of an experiment. And he was fully planning to try it for a couple of weeks and then go back to eating meat and, you know, dairy and all that kind of stuff. But his kind of value structure changed. And he said it was just down to his body changing and he no longer wanted meat. You know, in fact, it kind of turned him off. You know, his biome just had changed so much. It actually affected his values and his beliefs and all of these kind of things. So we do need to, you know, be very conscious of what we put into ourselves.
I completely agree. The more that I practice meditation and mindfulness, I stopped eating meat too. It became too dense. Like my body literally did not want that level of density.
So how do we then find the balance? Because you talked about, I mean, obviously you live in New York City, you try and get out into the country as often as you can.
I wouldn't say the country, but I do try to go to the park. Yeah. I'm going to be honest. I am totally 100% a city girl at heart. Me getting out in nature with insects and flying stinging things does not make me feel good, but I'm allergic to many of them. So I have reasons why. But I think you have to find those places that match your temperament and match your elemental constitution, which the elemental constitution is the type that you were speaking about. So I feel that my constitution is a very strong match for New York City. Like there is just a very, very, very strong resonance. And I feel completely at home in the city and that this truly is my home.
This is one of the things I wanted to get onto, really, because you talked about finding your constitution or your type. And in Ayurveda, they talk about the doshas. And apparently I am a Vata Kapha or a Kapha Vata.
Okay.
Those are my doshas. I don't really understand what it means or how that should impact my life. But you've talked about how understanding your type can lead you to your purpose. And then when you live with your purpose, that's when you live a life that is aligned with who you are. It's, you know, you feel content, you feel like you're fulfilling your potential, happiness, that kind of thing. So how do we discover our constitution? What is there an easy way to do this?
Absolutely. excuse me. I have two books. Both of them are really great resources. Not to prop my books up, but I have quizzes in there that actually help you fully define both your dosha and your elemental constitution. Now, when you look at Ayurveda, they talk about the three doshas. So it's a lot more rare to break it down to those five elemental types, which is why I do that in my vibrational healing book, complete quizzes for you to like understand both of those things. Now, an Ayurvedic practitioner, however, is going to have a full understanding of the five elements that make up the three doshas. They just don't break it down like that because it's, again, I believe they are looking at it solely in terms of broader strokes and how it relates to the body and not in terms of your psychology, your emotions, your purpose. Because in order to do that, you have to break things down a lot further. Now, let me give you an example. You said like Kapha dosha is one of yours. So in Ayurveda, Kapha dosha could have earth element and water element. So when you think about earth and when you think about water, do you think about any similarities between the two?
Well, I guess all I think of is the cycle, you know, the cycle from heaven to earth. That's it. That's the only thing that comes to mind. So I'm not well read on this, but
yeah, they're 180 degrees opposite. Earth is solid and tangible and unmoving and unflexible and rigid. And water is very flowing and dynamic, and it can be heated. It can be cold. I mean, I guess earth can to an extent, but if you think about the properties of what makes up earth and what makes up water, they are, they're completely different. All the elements are different. Earth, water, fire, air, and space. They're all completely different from each other. So even though Kapha dosha includes both earth and water, psychologically, emotionally, in terms of your purpose, in terms of how it's going to impact the way you relate to the world, it couldn't be any different than night and day. So again, earth people tend to be structured. They tend to be rigid. They tend to be good organizers. They tend to be good managers. They can get stuck in their ruts, or they can just, if they're living their purpose and everything effectively, they can be very good at creating systems and processes and structures. They like consistency. They like routine. Now, water-based people, they're very fluid. They're very flowing. They're going to have a hard time creating consistency and routine. They're going to be governed by feelings. Earth-based people, feelings and ration are going to be, you know, a little bit more balanced there. But water-based people, let's say if you were mostly all water, and we'll get into that later because you have everything inside of you, but some are more than others. You're going to be very feeling, very emotional, very caring and compassionate. You are going to be easily influenced by other people and situations. Just like you pour water into a glass, it's going to take on the shape of the glass or the container that it's in. This is the same with people who have a lot of water. They're going to become like the people they spend their time around. So it becomes very important for those type of people to learn how to set appropriate boundaries and to understand that just by their very nature, they're going to be more easily influenced by other people. So keep a good circle of friends. Earth-based people are going to be opposite. They're going to be the sort of people who are providing the structure and the consistency and the inspiration to other people. So again, you can't get any more opposite than earth and water. But if you just look at Kapha dosha, they're both included in that, like they're one and the same, and they're not the same at all.
So does that mean that as a kind of Kapha type, that's my dosha, does that mean I'm conflicted? Or does it just give me the information I need to
It just means that balance? It has not drilled the detail down to understand if you are more water or you are more earth.
Okay. So it requires further exploration, really.
Yes. It just, it's basically, it's what you need to know in terms of the physical body, because water and earth are still the two heaviest elements that are out there. So in Ayurveda, they're looking at it in terms of alleviating that density that comes from water and earth and bringing that back into balance. From a standpoint of the five elements, we're looking at how these elements impact your spirituality, impact your mind, impact your psychology, and a little bit less on the body. You can use your body as a way to identify these elements inside of you, but we're really looking at how do they impact your psychological and your emotional structure, because once you start to change those things, like that's necessary for making change in anything else.
So you've talked about how when you started to explore these things at the very beginning of your kind of current career, things started to work out for you. You healed physically. You talked about how you were financially in a difficult place and how that healed itself as well. So kind of as you healed within yourself, your situation healed as well.
And it's constantly growing and improving. That's what happens when you start to set a solid foundation. You know, I think if you don't have that solid foundation, you can't build anything that's substantial or meaningful or lasting. And having that, the health crisis, not wanting to test on animals, not liking the way my life was at the time, that was definitely not a solid foundation. So getting sick actually enabled me to clean up my entire life. I got to clean house, so to speak, and I got to rebuild from scratch. It was very difficult and it was very painful, but literally every single thing in my life was obliterated. Everything.
Do you think that we need a pain point like that? This is a question that kind of crops up time and time again. And Carl Jung
people need it. Some people I don't think could handle it. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of people, I would say the majority of people go through life with some kind of constant low level anxiety, discomfort, or dissatisfaction with where they are, who they are. Kind of, you know, a lot of people are making a lot of money, but they're very, you know, might be overweight, or they might have sort of failed marriages behind them, and that kind of thing. You know, what does it take to kind of say, I want to change myself so that I can change my world, if you like? You know, does there need to be a push?
Some level of crisis is necessary. I think you have to get to the point to where you are so open and so clear about what you want that you are willing to make change. That means you've got to penetrate down to the core of your being. And when you have all of that stuff sitting on top of it, the family, the job, the kids, it's very hard to get back to the core of who you are. So sometimes crisis can enable that opportunity for people to be able to go deeper than they've ever been able to go before. And that can be a pivotal change.
It's very difficult. You talked about knowing what you want. Is it that when you dig down, you discover what you want, or do you just discover kind of more questions that need answering, discover kind of things you don't want necessarily?
Yes, I think it's both. For me, working to understand my elemental constitution. So again, all of those elements have strengths and weaknesses associated with them. Like I was explaining some of those earlier with earth and water. Everything has a pro and everything has a con. And when you learn what those are, you can identify your strengths, you can identify your weaknesses. And when you look at the whole structure of everything that makes you you, you can learn how exactly your personal recipe or blueprint to use your strengths to minimize your weaknesses and eliminate them. So I think that that process of self-development and self-discovery helps you to understand what you are capable of doing, where your talents and strengths lie, and that can help you to find a meaningful career or a meaningful hobby or something that you're going to be able to use your skills in that are going to make you feel better. This whole system is literally this belief that, say, I have a lot of earth and fire. So I do like organization and structure and management and creating systems and processes. Writing is also a skill that is strongly related to earth element. So I am an author. I run a boutique PR agency. So everything that I do is based around the realm of communications and writing. That's very much in alignment with my energy type. So it's a natural extension of me. Because it's a natural extension of me, it does not cause stress or anxiety. So that is one way to look at it. When you are doing things that are in accordance with your nature, you're not going to get fatigued. You're not going to get tired. You're not going to get as stressed out. There's always stressors, but they're not the unnecessary stressors that you're going against your constitution. So I think looking inside and discovering that is hugely important, but we also have to look to our life experiences, because what has happened to us is what has defined what is meaningful for us. And a lot of times that means the difficulties, the painful, the traumatic situations that we've experienced in our life, that's going to influence the kind of difference you want to make in the world. So I think it's this combination of look at your constitution and your elemental makeup to understand where are my strengths and weaknesses so that I can align with day-to-day actions that are a natural extension of my energy, and also what has happened to me in my life that has not made me feel good, or that has made me feel good, and I want to go out and make a change in the world so other people can either experience this really good thing or not have to go through what I went through.
I think that one of the things you said there about these actions being a kind of natural extension of yourself, I think that's something I'd never considered before. You know, those things that kind of light you up or light your fire or make you feel good about yourself and the things you do, and extending that beyond yourself. I think it's quite a powerful, powerful concept, definitely.
And I think that that's where Ayurveda is a little bit lacking, because it, as a system, is focused on physical and mental and emotional health. But again, it's not as inclusive as, let's look at a five element structure of what makes you you and show you how all of these things are literally a part of you. Like, hey, say you've got a lot of earth, and you've got earth, I've got earth in my constitution. This is what it means psychologically for me. This is how it makes me think. Consistency, structure, organization, management, writing, those are all attributes of earth element, right? But you can also see it in your physical body structure, people who are earthy. So you said you also have Vata, so maybe you don't notice this as much, because Vata is very much like air and space. Vata people tend to be like taller, very slender, very willowy. Earth-based people tend to have a little bit more like stature to them. So you can even see it in your body. It's like, this is what I mean. This attribute, if you think about all of these things, like you're a soul, you haven't taken birth yet, right? You're floating out in the cosmos. You basically said, hey, this is what I want to go do in this lifetime. And then you created your entire physical body and mental structure and everything to enable you to do what you want to do. So that means you utilized these five elements, which is foundational building blocks for everything in existence, to create the body, the psyche, the emotional temperament that you needed to succeed. So when you start to look at it in terms of, hey, like all this is just truly, truly foundational, it's all interconnected. This is my desire for structure and organization and management is a reflection of my earth-based nature, and my physical body structure is also a reflection of my earth-based nature, and my desire to want to help other people communicate better through written word is also an extension of my earth-based nature. Then you start to think about everything so differently. It's like, oh, what could I really do if I aligned with myself?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, we often, you talk a lot about balance. Mm-hmm. And it's often when we're out of balance that we start to get stressed, we get fatigued, we get bored, we get obese. You know, we adopt kind of, I think like you've said before, we adopt unhealthy habits as crutches to help us deal with the dissatisfaction in other parts of our lives. So how do we start to bring it back in? Is it something that we can do just by finding something we're interested in, a hobby? Or can we undergo a complete life revolution and, you know, really find our purpose and start living a life that just puts a spring in our step every day and makes us feel like we're living our purpose?
I think both. I think you have to start by putting one foot in front of the other. And that usually means just taking a step at a time. Like, unless you're in a moment of crisis, it's very difficult to make a whole scale change in your life all at once. And if you do, it's very painful. Because the mind likes structure and stability and consistency. And in moments of crisis, you have none of that. So you are having to push through and create a reality when you don't feel good about anything. And that's very difficult. But if you start to just put one foot in front of the other and start to adapt specific daily practices that are going to help you understand your nature and your constitution and start living in accordance with them, I think that that is always a great way to start. And the more that you do that and you start feeling good, you're priming your system to do more things that enable you to feel good and to feel more in alignment.
I had a conversation a few episodes ago with an ultra runner, and he was a chap who goes and runs across the Sahara Desert for weeks at a time and stuff like that. And it doesn't sound like my idea of fun, but one of the things that he said that really kind of stuck with me is that action leads to motivation. You know, when mm-hmm. when you go for that first run, you're going to be much more likely to go for your second run, you know, and then eventually you become a runner. But it's going for that first one, taking that first step of action. Going back to your own story, what were some of the first actions that you took where you started to notice a shift in either yourself or your circumstances?
Meditation, adapting a daily meditation routine completely healed me of anxiety. I had pretty bad anxiety when I was younger, and I took anti-anxiety meds, like I took Xanax. After 6 months of consistent meditation, I never had to take any anxiety medicine ever again. And I started noticing the effects actually pretty quickly. It didn't take a full 6 months, but after 6 months, no more panic attacks, no more anything. So meditation was truly, truly foundational for me to start improving my mental health and sense of well-being.
And then ultimately it led you to essentially transform your life, create a new career for yourself. I mean, you must still have self-doubt. You must still have those kind of, I wake up every morning and the first thing I think about is like, oh God, what is the point? Why am I even doing this? You know, just give up right now.
I do have some self-doubt. Yes, I've done a lot of work on that because the self-doubt that I had before was crippling. And because it was so crippling and so much worse than what most people experience, I think I put in extra work into that to where I see it as completely night and day difference than where I was 15 years ago. I have an extreme high level of confidence in myself, in what I do, in what I bring to the world. I definitely think that there's still self-doubts there. But the doubts that come to me are more not about me. It's about what do I do right here and right now to move things forward in the way that I want to see them move forward. It's basically the doubt of not having all the answers to everything, which no one ever does, right? And I think that's part of the beauty and the process in life too. Like I don't doubt what I'm capable of. Sometimes I just question, is this the best course of action to take to facilitate the results I want to see?
So I suppose a bit like changing your relationship with your fears and your thoughts. It's like
yes. The
doubt pops up and it's like, actually, this is not something that is going to cripple me and paralyze me from taking action, but it's something that's going to show me the way to what I need to do next in a way, like a signpost.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And the only way to get rid of that deep self-doubt is to truly connect with consciousness, with God, whatever that energy is for you. You have to feel deeply and intrinsically loved by the universe. And once you feel that connection, that's what eliminates that doubt, that pain, that insecurity. And then you know that, hey, I can't really fail no matter what I do. Even if what I do is not successful, that does not mean that I am a failure or that I have failed. It means that I need to find a different way and a different approach to accomplish my goals, or I need to broaden my perspective to see maybe I'm not shooting for the right goal right now that is going to be best in alignment for what's going to bring me joy. It's just like, you got to understand you're co-creating your reality amongst this universal web of consciousness, and you've got all of the support around you at all times. You just got to tap into that.
That's going to be hard to do when you are physically kind of crippled by fibromyalgia. You've got all this self-doubt, you know, things are falling apart around you. It can be
yes
very
and no.
hard
it
to
can
feel
be
like
very
you're
hard, but you also have to. You also have to grab onto a lifeline when you're in moments of crisis. So sometimes faith is that lifeline for people. Faith is the start. Cultivating that real relationship takes the work.
How does that begin? How do you begin to do that if you say you don't have a kind of spiritual practice, or if you don't have religion or something like that, that you can turn to faith? How do you find the courage to kind of say, I'm just going to give it a go anyway, or I'm going to just, you know, what the hell, I've tried everything else. I'm going to just have some faith that, you know, it's worth the effort to do this.
That's a very good question. And I don't know that I have a good answer for you. And that is because I grew up as a very religious person. I am now not religious at all. I walked away from religion in pursuit of spirituality many years ago, but I always had a foundation. You know, I mean, I was like brought up in the church. So brought up in the Christian faith. So what you did, I grew up as a Seventh-day Adventist. I went with my grandmother to Baptist church. I went with my parents to Seventh-day Adventist church. So it was mostly like on Saturdays, but we'd go to church every Saturday. And it was just what you did. We would go to Bible study. I was like always at church. So this idea of faith and God being there for you was grilled into me from the time I was an infant. So I think that it's always been kind of fundamental to who I am to understand that even if I didn't have as much of a personal connection as I wanted, that there was this lifeline that you could reach out to even when you needed it. For me, when I came to my moment of crisis, I had known for quite a while at that point that religion was not the answer for me. I'd already walked away from it at that point, but I knew that God was always there and God was always listening. And I just felt deeply in my heart, that very silent voice, but that voice that makes you feel you need to cultivate this connection and that will give you the answers. So maybe that's a good place for people to start, just to see if you can find that inner voice that says, you're not alone. Keep looking, keep seeking. Yep.
Keep turning up every day and doing the work, because keep showing up. You can't see the results now, at some point, this is going to start paying off for you.
I mean,
perhaps that's another symptom of a kind of sick society that we live in. You know, we're kind of told to give over ownership of our lives to the systems that surround us, you know, the education system, the capitalist system that gives us our processed foods and our processed information. Maybe it's kind of taken away our faith in our, you know, ability to take risks and step into the void a little bit, and to just kind of say, let's see what happens if we just keep doing this thing day in, day out, and getting better.
It's very funny that you say that. I tend to take a lot of leaps of faith forward, like a grasshopper. And yeah, sometimes it's incredibly painful. Sometimes you take a leap and it doesn't work out. But you have to take those leaps to understand that things do work out too. Yeah. Sometimes start with that small little leap of faith. You know, take a little micro step forward, and then eventually it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're going to believe that the universe is there for you and does have your back. Yes, 100% of the things are not going to work for you, but that's life. That's statistics. We can't make every single endeavor that we want work the way that we want it to. But the more you do take those leaps of faith and keep stepping forward, you're going to see that the universe shows up for you, because you're showing up for yourself.
How much do you think a practice of showing up for yourself is vital? You know, actually, kind of, you talked about routines before, and how for you anyway, there, and possibly for me as well, being a kapha dosha, you know, these routines actually help us kind of keep turning up every day.
Yes, I think they're crucial for everyone, to be honest with you. I think that as earth-based people, we recognize that more, because we crave for consistency more. But consistency is necessary to form strong and stable neural connections in the brain. Having a consistent daily habit is the only way that we break old neural connections and start to form new ones. So it's integral. And I think the more that you show up for yourself and you are doing something consistent for yourself each and every day, you are changing your mental wiring to believe that you are important, you are competent, you are capable, you are worthwhile. So you have to do something, no matter what it is, each and every day, to show yourself that you're awesome, amazing, and worth it.
Do you think it's frightening to actually face your failings? Because you have to face them to deal with them. But do you think that's what people are scared of? They're kind of saying, I know I'm overweight, I know I'm unhappy, but actually it's easier for me to bury myself in fast food or bad habits than it is to actually turn around and say, well, why am I unhappy? What is out of balance here?
I think that we're actually afraid of our successes, because if you believed that you could actually be successful, you would have to deal with the guilt and remorse of, why did I choose to live unhappy for so long?
Did you feel that guilt when you started to get into alignment with yourself and things started to work out?
I did not, because I felt that I had done everything I had needed to at every point in my journey. For some reason, I was capable of showing myself an extreme amount of compassion. A lot of people are not capable of doing that. I feel that my life has intrinsically changed at every single point as it has needed to. But a lot of people tend to be very, very critical of themselves. If they have, like you said, if they're overweight, or if they are neglecting their relationship, or just not willing to step up and do the work. I think that I don't have regrets, because I always step up and did the work that I needed to in my life to the best of my ability. But if you are in a place to where there's been things that you haven't been able to overcome or do, And then you suddenly realize that, hey, I am capable. I was always capable of doing this. Why did I not do it? It can cause a lot of mental pain and struggle in people. So I think we're not afraid of failure because everyone fails at some point or another. I think that's kind of the normal place of existing for a lot of people. It's that fear of success that keeps them from actually being successful, because then they have to face their own internal God and say, yeah, I was always capable of this, so why did I not?
Do you think that maybe there's a bit of a kind of stigmatism attached to success, to happiness? You know, that we're also addicted to guilt, yes, and to suffering, that mm-hmm, when we do find happiness, we almost feel bad about it.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
And we just have to deal with it, I guess, and just like, come on, just be happy. You know, do the things that are going to bring happiness into your life.
I think it is intrinsic also to want to give to other people and to want to see other people happy. And then when you see that other people are not truly happy, that perpetuates the guilt that you may feel for yourself when you realize, hey, I've got all of these great things going for me, or I have the capability of building these great things in my life, and I'm on a good trajectory towards reaching my goals, because a lot of people, they're just not in that state. So it's this very fine balance between being an individual and being part of a collective society. And that's a hard balance for people, especially in learning where are those boundaries? How much of the societal pain do I want to feel? And how much am I going to let it impact me and my decisions?
Absolutely. You've talked about how kind of physical and mental health, happiness, they're all kind of side effects of living a life, a sort of life that's in balance with your purpose. Does your purpose definitely have to include some kind of physical well-being practice, as well as kind of eating well? And, you know, what if you find your purpose is in something very sedentary, or, you know, like writing, or like, you know, stamp collecting or something like that? You know, do you have to engineer in kind of, you know, physical healthy lifestyle habits as well? Or will, yes, those kind of look after themselves?
I think I wouldn't call any of those other things purpose. I think you need to get like very clear about like what your purpose is, that's in alignment with your temperament, your elemental constitution, all of that. That may be your purpose. And also keep in mind, purpose can change and evolve as we grow and we change and evolve. But I think that all these other practices that we do on a daily basis are necessary for us to feel the importance of purpose and to empower us to live it. If you're not eating healthy, you're not taking care of your gut microbiome, your physical body, there's no way that you're going to have the stamina or the resources to go out and live your purpose. Even if your purpose is sedentary, like I sit at my desk a lot. It's also why I am very active and I do Pilates and I do so much dance. It's ludicrous. Like, despite the fact that I sit at my desk all day, every day, I'm equally as active in the other parts of my life. If, yeah, I didn't do these other things, then I would not be able to fulfill my purpose.
And I guess that's what you're talking about when you talk about balance as well. You know, it's you see something
harmony,
that,
yes,
yeah, absolutely.
Balance, harmony.
Is finding the places where you're out of balance, you've got this kind of imbalances going on, is it really obvious? Does it present itself to you in your life? I mean, the obvious things could be ill health, but when it comes to you're feeling stressed or tired or fatigued, and you can't quite put your finger on why. I mean, is it easy to find that out? Is it that you could be doing something
that's not aligned with you? It's not always easy, but for me, I try to go back to the basics. Am I meditating? Am I clearing out all those external stimuli that could be impacting me? I'm very empathic by nature, so I do tend to pick up on a lot of my external environment. So for me, the first thing is always to say, how much of this is my burden and how much of this is what is going on around me? Meditation helped for me. The practices that I do help to clear that out. So one, am I meditating and clearing my energetic field on a consistent and regular basis? Two, am I eating a healthy and consistent diet? Sometimes that goes to the back burner for me when I get extremely busy. Like I said, I'm an author and a speaker and I run a company. So and I'm single, so I don't like have people here taking care of me. So sometimes my eating practices are not what they should be. And so that's something that I know for me, I have to be very attentive of. Like if I'm not taking care of my body, I'm not taking care of my microbiome or anything.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I know when I'm not rested or if I've had too much to drink, you know, two nights ago, then it affects my confidence. My anxiety goes up. My ability to make decisions and be confident in those decisions is impacted quite heavily. So this kind of physical wellness, you know, looking after ourselves, what we put into our body, does make a big difference. So you've talked about carving out time for ourselves as well as being kind of vital to finding out what we are in alignment with, just finding time. I mean, you mentioned in your TEDx talk about just sitting down, have a cup of tea even, or, you know, it could be something like going for a jog or just finding some time to yourself. I mean, that can be very, very difficult for people who are very, very busy. But is it vital? I mean, you're a very, very busy person, obviously. And I've done coaching sessions where people have literally come to me and I've said, you know, you need to find some time to sit down and do this and that. And they kind of say to me, I don't have any time. I get up at 5 a.m. after the kids go to bed and it's dinner. And then it's, you know, it's time for, you know, me to do my second job. And then it's bedtime. You know, how can we, is it a matter of priorities that we just kind of have to force ourselves to just take some downtime?
Yes. And there is an old saying attributed to some Buddhist monk somewhere, I'm sure, that said, so the monk's like, oh, you should go meditate for 10 minutes a day, right? And the guy comes back and says, I don't have time for that. So he turns around and said, okay, you should go meditate for an hour a day.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think that's the message, is that the more that you're doing and the more active that you are in everything, you absolutely have to make that time for yourself. And if you don't, it's going to be more detrimental to you. And this goes back to what I said before. We tend to get in our ruts and our systems and our structures, which oftentimes can look like failure. So I think that this whole process of showing up for yourself each and every day is truly foundational for shifting your mindset and your outlook and those decisions that you're going to make. If you show up yourself for yourself every day, 7 days in a row, I guarantee you how you're going to relate to your life after that point is going to be different. You're going to make different decisions in your daily life, which are going to better impact you and all of the people around you.
I mean, Stephen Covey, I don't know if you've read any of his work, but he,
yes,
I guess,
I'm familiar with his work.
Well, he calls it sharpening the saw. You know, he says, if you give me 5 hours to chop down a tree, I'll spend the first four sharpening my saw, you know, because then you're more effective at doing the other things. And yes, I suppose this is what this is all about. The kind of more rested you are, the more in alignment with your purpose, the better you are at showing up in the rest of your life. You know, if you're
that's
dealing with stress,
true,
and, you know, wellness and that kind of thing.
You're raising your whole vibrational frequency. You are making it easier for other people to relate to you. When you show up for yourself, you unconsciously give other people the ability to show up for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it is very hard. This is probably the last point. It's very hard. I find I'm very good at meditating when I feel good, but when life is getting stressful and I'm tired, it kind of doesn't, it seems a bit silly to meditate because I've got more important things I need to be dealing with. I've got this kind of massive workload. My to-do list is getting out of control. I need to focus on that. And kind of prioritizing meditation can seem a little bit like I'm not dealing with the seriousness of the situation. How can we convince ourselves to just, you know, keep turning up even when we think it seems daft or silly or flippant, you know?
Have the conversation with yourself to where you are telling yourself consistently that meditation and mindfulness is how I show up in the proper mindset for other people and for every situation and circumstance in my life. And once you truly believe that at the core of your being, that you have to wipe away those external stimuli, that you have to be clear, that you have to be energetically strong, because that's also what meditation does. Teach yourself that this is for you, but it's ultimately for other people. You want to show up to be your best all the time for everyone in your life, whether that's your colleagues, your spouse, your children, your friends. This is going to help you help them in such a profound way you can't even put words to it.
I think that's brilliant. That's a great message to end on, I think, there. And it's just, I think it just goes to show we often see these things as being quite selfish when we kind of take ourselves away. You know, we feel selfish, but actually we're doing it for a greater good. So in terms of your books and more information about the work you do, where can people go to find out more about you?
Very easy to find. JayaJayaMyra.com, at JayaJayaMyra on all social media.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, I shall leave you to get on. But thank you so much for today. I really appreciate it. And
thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
That was a wonderful conversation, and I feel enthused and empowered to embark on the self-discovery to figure out how I can turn my life into an extension of myself. As I mentioned, you can find out more about Jaya Jaya at her website, which is www.jayajayamyra.com. And if you want to hear more episodes of the podcast, then don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you find it. And also, just tell your friends, tell anyone you meet, share the love, because it all helps to spread the word about what we're doing here at Conversations on Living. You can also check out conversationsonliving.com, where you'll have all the episodes that we've recorded so far. And there's also more information there about my writing, my meditations, my books. And you can sign up to the newsletter. And if you do, you will get a free freebie to download. And if you want to carry on the conversation, then head over to the Facebook group. Just search for Conversations on Living. Next week, I'm very excited to be joined by Scott Schwenk, and we'll be talking about taking ownership of our perspective and our reality and using breath as a tool for just letting go and getting rid of those kind of negative narratives that define our days. And in the meantime, just all that remains is for me to say, have a lovely day.